Next case is 07-333, Disciplinary Counsel versus Robert Broeren.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Philip Lemkuhl of Mount Vernon, Ohio. I represent Robert Broeren, also of Mount Vernon, Ohio. My presentation should take about 7 minutes, and I propose to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. The Board of Commissioners in this case found that my client, Robert Broeren, violated four rules, and we do not dispute two of those. He admits violation of DR 9-102B4 because he failed to promptly surrender client files to substitute counsel, believing he had an attorney lien on such files due to non-payment of his fees. In addition, there is no dispute as to violation of Bar Rule Roman numeral 546, failure to cooperate. When he was first contacted about this matter by disciplinary counsel, he failed to timely respond to their inquiry, although the Board of Commissioners found that he ultimately became very cooperative with the investigation into his conduct. Mr. Broeren steadfastly denies the other two violations, the first of which is neglect of a legal matter entrusted to him. And on the basis of the record now before this court, there is ample reason to hold that he did not neglect a legal matter entrusted to him. Near the end of the first year of his solo practitioner civil practice, he was hired to represent PMR Products of New York, Albany, as a defendant in a $2,100 collection case in the Municipal Court of Mount Vernon, Ohio.
And so the panel concluded, and I gather that's the reason the sanction that they recommended took place. They concluded that he lied to the panel about a couple of letters. They concluded that he backdated the letters. And that seems to me to be the most serious thing that occurred here.
I agree, sir.
There doesn't seem to be much dispute that he had a bad client, and sooner or later every lawyer faces that, and it can be difficult to handle, and it can frequently lead to trouble when you get connected up with somebody who's hard to work with and demanding unrealistic things. And so the panel seems to accept that. But their conclusion that he backdated a couple of letters to make his situation seem better once he's under the gun here is what's troubling.
I'd be happy to address that, Justice Pfeiffer. I brought with me today those two letters, photo enlarged. I was hoping to have an easel here, but don't. But these are the two letters at issue.
Well, my question is...
Jason, okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought I was going to have you hold them up. Good, there is an easel.
In response to your question, sir, or Justice Pfeiffer, the first one is what I call the template letter. That is dated June 16, 2004. What I've done for the benefit of the court is this. I have highlighted in yellow the language from this letter, which also appears in the second letter. The language in blue was deleted. Both letters are part of Exhibit 19 of the record. The court will observe this upon examination of the record. The primary purpose of this letter was to transmit the judgment entry from the decision of the court. The trial was held July 11th, 2004. The judgment entry was dated June 14th, 2004. This letter, June 16th, transmitted that entry, advised the recipient of his appellate rights. By contrast, the second letter, is also color-coded. The yellow language here, Your Honor, is language common to the first letter. The pink language here is new material. The primary purpose of this letter was vastly different from the first. The primary purpose of this second letter, Justice Pfeiffer, was to transmit a judgment debtor examination notice. Now, what my client did badly, and he explained that this in his testimony, is you'll notice it is dated June 18th, 2004. Yet it attaches a notice of a judgment debtor exam dated in July. When he made this letter on his laptop, he correctly dated it the 18th of the month, but left the wrong month in there. The month should have been July. That's mistake number one. Mistake number two is he left the yellow language from the first letter in the second letter. He so testified on the record, that's how it happened. Now, why should you believe that explanation in lieu of the conclusion reached by the panel that the letters were backdated? Simply this. When you consider that the trial occurred June 11th, 2004, and Mr. Lubin testified he knew of the trial the day before, but wasn't going to go. Once the trial is over, what incentive is there for my client to backdate letters relating to, number one, your appellate rights, here's your entry, here's the decision of the court, and the second, which is, here's your judgment debtor exam. He cannot conceal any malpractice on his part by such letters, for if there had been malpractice, it had occurred on trial day or before. Instead, I submit, Justice Pfeiffer, the explanation offered by my client at the hearing that this was sloppiness, inattention to detail, a manifestation of his ADD, is the far more persuasive explanation.
You know, you just made the same argument that you made to the panel, and the panel concluded differently. Obviously, we don't usually second guess the panel, the hearing panel's conclusions, because those three members, of course, see the witnesses and they have the opportunity to make determinations that we can't make here, because obviously there's no hearing. What's your strongest argument? It's exactly the argument you made, as I read the briefs that you made to the panel. Why should we discount the panel's conclusion in favor of your argument here?
Because the burden of proof, Mr. Chief Justice, is clear and convincing. All right, and we submit that you have here before you an equally, if not more, plausible explanation than the inference drawn by the panel. This body sits to assess the sufficiency of the evidence, and we submit, and submitted in our brief, that the evidence does not meet the requisite standard, the standard being clear and convincing evidence.
It wasn't the dispute ultimately about the client was claiming, hey, he didn't tell me any of this stuff. I didn't know what was going on. And so the letters, rather than covering perhaps malpractice, or the issue of whether he actually sent the letters or whether he made the letters up after the client's trying to bring the roof in on him, relates to notice to the client rather than how he handled the hearing. He apparently went to the hearing and did the best he could for a client who was let's give the lawyer the benefit of the doubt, the client was wrong and should have lost. So he didn't perhaps commit malpractice of any kind, and that shouldn't necessarily be a part of discipline, but the question is the client saying, I just didn't know any of this was going on.
Your Honor, Mr. Lubin did in fact testify at the hearing that he had not seen this letter or the other one I showed you prior to September. That was his testimony at the hearing. But he did testify about having a discussion about the trial prior to it occurring on June 11, 2004. He knew it was coming. He knew when it was coming. He knew what the issues were. He knew he wasn't going to show up at that trial. The other thing that is revealed by the record is that when it came to the second sanction imposed upon the client, Mr. PMR Products, $500, failure to appear at a judgment debtor examination, that the court itself notified Mr. Lubin of that date directly by mail, and he failed to appear and was sanctioned $500. I hope that answered your question about what the record reflects in those matters.
It still leaves us with the quandary that the discipline recommended here seems to focus on whether or not your client made up these letters later to keep himself out of disciplinary problems rather than what it meant to the client at the time.
And in that regard, Justice Pfeiffer, you have to look at what the allegations were of misconduct in order to evaluate whether this could conceivably be part of a cover-up. All right? The allegations of misconduct by Mr. Lubin focused on two matters. A $500 sanction imposed upon PMR Products for failure to respond to discovery in a timely way. That obviously occurred pre-trial. The second, a $500 sanction occurring in September of 2004.
And counsel, what I'm trying to relate to you, from my personal perspective on this, if that's all we had is Mr. Lubin's gripes, I would think this ought to be dismissed. But we have something more substantial here that the panel found, and that's what's troubling. And that, they found that he created a couple letters to keep him out of disciplinary problems.
These two letters, however, Your Honor, conceal nothing regarding those two sanction events. In other words, if you assume the proposition, the panel said these letters were sent out in September, backdated in order to cover something up. These letters cover up nothing relating to the allegations of misconduct by Mr. Lubin. In other words, if that's the conclusion, these were part of a cover-up, they don't cover anything.
But I thought part of his allegation was he just didn't tell me. And we find that sometimes with lawyers, and we take a dim view of that. That is, that lawyers go to court and they settle things without authority. They receive checks and cash them without authority. They do things that they're supposed to tell the client they're doing and don't do it. And I thought that was part of what the client was complaining about here.
He complained about lack of communication primarily related to those two sanction events, Your Honor. All right, the $500 sanction for failure to timely provide discovery and the post-trial $500 sanction for failure to appear at the JD exam. But in his testimony, he also said that monetarily, that's all he was seeking, those two sanction amounts. The $500 and the $500, the $1,000. And we submit, Your Honor, in lieu of the 6-month suspension recommended by the panel, have my client, Mr. Bruin, pay that $1,000, those two sanctions. It would be a better remedy. May I continue?
Sure. Would you run that by me again? Why would he be paying the two $500 sanctions?
We have two rules at issue. Having admitted we've got two violations already, disputing two. The two remaining, Justice O'Connor, are these. Neglect of a matter entrusted to him. The panel
found
him.
He admits that he neglected it.
No. He denies that, but the panel found he had neglected. And so what we are submitting to you, Justice O'Connor, is this. If you uphold that finding that he neglected, what was the harm? The harm was the two $500 sanctions. In lieu of a suspension for that offense, have him pay the two sanctions. That is our recommendation.
Well, he should pay those anyway, shouldn't he?
The panel did not recommend them, Your Honor.
No, but
we propose that as an alternative remedy.
Like, okay.
The record also reveals that Mr. Braun, on behalf of this client, negotiated two settlements, both of which were rejected by Mr. Lubin. The first involved a 50% payment of the $2,100. Mr. Lubin rejected that. The second, far more creative solution negotiated by Mr. Roren, was that PMR would return the allegedly defective merchandise to the plaintiff, who, if it was defective, would give them credit. If it was not defective but could be resold, would give them credit. Mr. Lubin rejected that offer as well. That's uncontested in the record that these two settlements were in fact negotiated.
I have another question for you. Mr. Lubin went to another attorney, Mr. Doling, and according to our information here, Doling wrote to the respondent regarding this case early October, again in late October, then November, and then I believe there was a letter subsequent to that, late November, and then January of 05. None of those letters were responded to by your client.
Correct. He did not, Justice O'Connor, respond directly to the author of those letters, Mr. Doling. The record, however, reveals that he did respond directly one time only to the client, Mr. Lubin, by phone call, saying, in effect, I would be happy to give your records back to you, but you need to pay my fee. That was his only response to those letters. And that violation, Justice O'Connor, has been admitted by Mr. Brewer. It's not in contention here today.
Well, here's the way I'm seeing this. Is it a pattern of just burying your head and not responding to the problems that are confronting you? Neglect of a matter, neglect of this case, and its process through the municipal court, not responding, precipitating the sanctions. Then when things go awry subsequent to the trial, and I'm not saying that he could have won the trial, don't get me wrong there, but failure to communicate appropriately with the client, then failure to communicate with the attorney that the client has then gone to try and pursue this matter, and then failure to initially respond to the inquiry by the disciplinary process. To me, there's a complete pattern here of this respondent ignoring, for whatever reason, and not responding and not responding, and then voila, he comes up with two letters to bring to the hearing that is supposed to explain everything?
They don't. These two letters that you have just referred to, Justice O'Connor, have no bearing upon the grievances of the client during the scope and course of the representation. They have no bearing or relationship to the two sanction events. All right. Now, as to the balance of what you said, yes, he did fail to respond to Doling. He did fail to promptly turn over the records. He thought he had a good rationale for doing so. He now knows better. He admits that violation. The second one, Justice O'Connor, and that is his failure to cooperate with the disciplinary counsel. You're right, the same pattern. Initially, he did not respond to their letters. Once he began to cooperate, he was praised by the Board of Commissioners for his cooperation once it began. So it was a delay in cooperation, not a total failure.
Thank you, Mr. Lamkuhl.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Beckman.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Stacey Solacek-Chapman on behalf of the Relator Disciplinary Council. As was noted in Mr. Lehmkuhl's discussion, the panel had found that the respondent violated DR 1102A4 for creating and fabricating the June 16th and June 18th letters. And Mr. Lehmkuhl suggested that the respondent would have had no motivation to do that. The hearing was over, the trial had been done. Let me suggest what his motivation was, and if you'll pardon my expression, they were cover your ass letters. That's exactly what they were. The respondent dropped the ball when he was representing Mr. Lubin. He didn't advise Mr. Lubin in June of the decision. He didn't advise Mr. Lubin in July that there was a
counsel,
motion for judgment debtor.
Did Mr. Lubin know about the trial on the 11th?
He knew about the trial on June 10th.
And I guess that's what I got from the record, too, that he didn't receive a letter saying, gee, we're going to trial, once that trial date was set, I believe, in April. There was no communication from a respondent to his client that June 11th is our trial date.
June 11th is our trial date, and that's an interesting thing in that the panel also found that there was a May 7th letter, and the May 7th letter was purportedly sent to Mr. Lubin saying, we have a trial on June 11th, and I want to meet with you, and I want to meet with Mr. Grignon, who is an employee at PMR, to discuss your testimony the day before. The panel found that letter to be less than credible as well, because Mr. Lubin said, I never received that letter. I got that letter on June 10th when Mr. Broren, the respondent, sent it to me.
I got that letter on June 10th.
On June 10th. He faxed it to me on June 10th after our telephone call to try and say, well, yeah, I told you a month ago about this trial date. And that's consistent with exactly what happened with the September fax. I told you these things in June, and I told you about the judgment debtor examination in July. I sent you these letters. Here, let me fax them to you again. But Mr. Lubin was clear. He did not receive the May 7th letter until June 10th, the day before the trial. He did not receive the June 16th letter until September. He did not receive the June 18th letter, which Mr. Lehmkuhl is suggesting was supposed to be dated July 18th, rather, until September. This is a pattern. This is a pattern of wanting to cover up what he had failed to do.
Counsel,
go ahead. That second letter, though, also has additional language that really makes no sense.
So absolutely.
The idea that it was typographical and sloppy, I mean, if we were to independently find that to be the case, do you then have clear and convincing evidence of this particular disciplinary violation?
Of the 1102A4?
Or must we defer to the panel in this case?
I think that when you look at the inconsistencies of these letters, and may I use the letters that Mr. Lehmkuhl
sure.
showed you? The date. He says here, I will be in Ireland from June 30th to July 11th. He's back by that point if this letter is supposed to be dated July 18th. He would never have added that. And this is why
no, counsel, wait a minute. If you're talking about something that's on your computer and you're talking about using that as a format for an additional letter, you could see where that language, if someone's being sloppy, that language is not deleted when the date is not straightened out as well.
I can see where the language would not be deleted. This line, please contact me before June 30th or after July 11th, he added that. He would not have added that. That's an addition. That is not a cut and paste. That is, let me add this line in. Now, would it be more likely that in September, when he's creating letters trying to recollect what was going on, that he may have added it then? That's absolutely more likely. And that's what the panel saw. He testified that these were errors. The panel did not believe him. They were able to assess his credibility and did not believe him.
Counsel, the timing, these letters in this form had been faxed to the client in September.
Correct.
And the panel is sometime later, right?
I apologize.
The panel hearing is much later than that. So if he fabricated these to get the client off his back, he's still in a better situation today if he came clean about that to the panel.
Correct.
Right. So my take is that part of why the panel's upset is they think these letters are what you described. They're done for the reason that you described, but he's clinging to it when he's got a discipline case, and he should have given it up.
I would agree with that.
And that's really what's troubling the panel in terms of the recommendation for
sanction. I think certainly.
Because otherwise, he's got a clean record, apparently a good lawyer, and this, so far as we know, is a one-time event. Probably should have handled, I mean, we don't know all the conversations between him and the client. He probably should have pulled the plug on this client long before the trial and just said, look, I'm never going to satisfy you, and I don't think your case is going to be anything but a loser, and you should find alternative counsel.
In hindsight,
that's what should have happened before the trial even.
In hindsight, I'm certain that the respondent feels that he should have done that now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I want to finish answering Justice Lanzinger's question about whether or not these letters standing alone get us to clear and convincing evidence. I think they do. But notwithstanding that, look at the other evidence in the record. You have Mr. Lubin's testimony that he didn't receive these letters in June and or July. And you have the letters that Mr. Doling sent to the respondent asking about the case. And several of those letters specifically say, could you explain this to me? Explain how there's a June 18th letter that purports to include a July 15th order. Now, I don't know what the respondent would do, but if I received a letter from another lawyer saying, you fabricated something, I would write back to that other lawyer. I would call that other lawyer and say, that's not what's happened. And he didn't respond to any of those letters. This isn't just burying his head in the sand. He didn't respond to accusations of fabrication way back in October and November of 2004. That's what I think, when you look at the whole picture, shows that there's the violation of 1102A4. It's more than the inconsistencies in the letters. It's what's in the record altogether. And the panel specifically found that the respondent lacked credibility when they found that he wrote the May 7th letter and that lacked credibility, that the June 18th and June 16th letters were backdated. They suggested that they were fabricated, and they suggested that he gave false testimony and fabricated evidence at the hearing. They were able to assess his credibility. They witnessed him. They witnessed the other witnesses, and there's no reason to deviate from that finding under these circumstances. When you look at the neglect in this matter, yes, he showed up at the trial. Yes, he presented a defense at the trial. But what he didn't do was respond to discovery requests in a timely manner. He didn't respond to a motion to compel. He didn't inform his client of the motion to compel. He didn't inform his client of the trial in a timely manner. He didn't inform his client of the decision. He didn't inform his client of the judgment entry. And he didn't respond to six letters requesting the case file. All of that constitutes neglect. The violation of a DR 6101A3 was proven by clear and convincing evidence, and the panel found that as well.
Let me direct you to one of the last things that counsel for the respondent asked, and that is a monetary fine of $1,000 to make up for the two $500 sanctions that have been leveled against presumably the client here. And I would imagine there'd have to be some kind of finding of maybe a public reprimand is what he's asking for, although he didn't mention that, instead of actual suspension.
I would disagree with that. I think, first of all, should this court find, as the panel did, that there was a violation of DR 1102A4 for fabricating evidence, the message we would send to other attorneys as to the sanction you may receive when you create letters to provide either to your client or to the panel during a hearing is less than an actual suspension would be a very bad message to send if we were to only give some type of monetary penalty. Now, notwithstanding that, certainly, I would agree if this court wants to order a $1,000 penalty or fine of some sort, reimbursement, to go along with an actual suspension. That's a great idea. But I don't think anything less than an actual suspension in this matter is warranted. I think given the case law out there that were cited in the relator's brief of cases similar to this, where the attorney created or fabricated a letter, I think that stepping away from a six-month suspension would be an inappropriate choice.
But that wasn't what our decision was in the Fauerbach case, was it?
The decision in the Fauerbach case?
Yeah, wasn't that a fabrication of evidence?
I believe it was. Was
there an actual suspension in
Fauerbach? Is the case that started an actual suspension. Where there is misrepresentation to a client and a violation of 1102A4, an actual suspension is warranted. That began with Fauerbach.
Thank you.
I want to just mention very briefly the respondent's suggestion that the panel overlooked his attention deficit disorder as mitigation. And while Mr. Lemkuhl didn't mention that, I have a feeling he might when he comes back up. And so I just want to touch on that. There are four factors that the guidelines in looking at mitigation set forward here. And while the respondent established two of them, a diagnosis as well as treatment, and that he's been treating with Dr. Gideon King since April of 2006, there was no mention of the two that are most critical, and that is a causal connection between the misconduct, and in this case, the respondent only admits to the misconduct involving the failure to cooperate and the failure to return, and suggests that he ignored those letters and failed to do that because of his ADD. There's no causal connection that was established by Dr. King or Stephanie Krznarich that suggests that his ADD caused that misconduct. There's also no prognosis by Stephanie or Dr. King as to what the respondent's ability to engage in a competent practice of law might be should the ADD be considered mitigation. And both of those are factors that must be considered when looking at mitigation. Unless there's any more questions, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beckman. Mr. Lemkuhl, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
In an 18th letter, Your Honor,
transmits a document dated July 15th. It obviously could not have been dated in June.
Mr. Lemkuhl, it's hard to read those exhibits. Would you please read both letters?
I would be happy to.
Thank you.
June 16th letter. Dear Mr. Lubin, enclosed is a copy of the court's final order in regards to this matter, which was received today in the mail today. Under the Ohio rules, you have 28 days from the date message filed and appealed. I will be in Ireland June 30, 2004 to July 11, 2004, so please contact me before June 30, 2004 to discuss this. Next paragraph. Enclosed is an invoice for services rendered through today. Please note that I have not received payment for the January and March 2004 invoices.
And you're saying that was the original letter with no, all right.
The letter used to create the set. Now, of course, he's speaking in the future tense about going to Ireland. The second letter, dated June 18, 2004, but obviously written sometime in July. Dear Mr. Lubin, enclosed is a copy of a judgment debtor exam, which Selective Med has scheduled on August 20, 2004, which I received in the mail today. And indeed, the attachment was dated July 15, 2004. Next sentence. This is the part carried over from the first that should not.
Wait a minute. He received the notice, he said, what I received today, which was
in July.
July 15th.
Which is the timestamp date, and then he got it on the 18th, allegedly.
Yes.
Go ahead.
In that letter, or in that JD exam scheduling, the JD exam is scheduled for August 20th. Then there's the fragment carried over from the preceding letter that makes no sense. I will be in Ireland, future tense. I will be in Ireland from June 30, 2004 to July 11, 2004. So please contact me before June 30, 2004 or after July 11, 2004 to discuss the yellow language here and the yellow language here, identical, a bad cut and paste job.
Wait a minute, does the second one or the first one say or after July 11th?
It says the first one, I will be in Ireland from June 30, 2004-July 11, 2004, so please contact me before June 30, 2004 to discuss this. This language, Your Honor, also is identical in the sense that it says I will be in Ireland from June 30, 2004-July 11, 2004, so please contact me before June 30, 2004, and then additional language, or after July 11, 2004 to discuss this. It makes no sense for this language to be in this letter, it's speaking in the future tense, when by way of attachment and the date of the attachment, we know this could not have been written before July.
Although the second letter adds additional language, or after July 11th, which is not in the first, correct?
Correct.
So it's a little bit different than just saying he forgot to delete that language, because apparently in the second letter there's additional language inserted.
And yes, Your Honor, that is correct. There are a few additional words at the end. But at the hearing, of course, the testimony was that this is a classic manifestation of attention deficit disorder. He didn't pay attention to what he was doing. A classic symptom. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lemko. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.